All right, so let us start. So good morning. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the General Relativity course. I'm David. And so this course will be taught by me, partly the first 3 weeks. And then we will have Ghazal finishing what I start. And we also, let me introduce Sotiros, who is going to be our TA. And so he's responsible for all your grades and everything. So please have that in your mind when you submit him some treats and stuff like that. All right, so basically the approximate plan is as follows over here. By the way, there is a web page where you should access, you should be able to access like the exact plan, and where you should be able to access the study text for this course and so on. So that's already there. So anyway, so the approximate plan is week one, we will do GR without GR. Basically, we will see how far we can go without using any differential geometry. Okay, and of course, we can go quite far. We can get a lot of predictions of general relativity without actually understanding anything about differential geometry. And I will try to convince you about that in the first week. And then, of course, there is a certain point where you need to learn some differential geometry, and we will do that in week two. And then equipped with these new tools, we will go to the foundations of general relativity in week three. So now my understanding is that you have taken the classical physics course, and that, of course, that course teaches you about the action principle and all these things. So we will actually approach GR from the action principle. So we will discuss Einstein-Hilbert action and then go from there. And then I will miss, so that's the groundwork which I'm going to do. And then it's Ghazal who is going to discuss with you all the fun topics. So she will do the fun. And she will do the applications to black holes. She will do the applications to gravitational waves, and maybe something else as well. Okay, we shall see. All right, so please ask questions. Whenever you have a question, please do ask. There's also a secret tool how to ask questions secretly. I don't know really how to access that, but Ghazal will help me with that. So anyway, so that's another option how you can ask questions. But I'm not going to bite you, so please raise your hand and ask questions. All right. Are there any questions at this point? Yes.
Please, can you remind your name?
David.
David.
Very important. All right. So let me just directly dive into that, and let's see how far we can go with GR without actually understanding anything about manifolds and tensors and stuff like that. So chapter one will be introduction. Oh, maybe better first look at GR without differential geometry. Okay, and we start from a very natural point, which actually was the crucial thing which Einstein developed very early days when he was thinking about general relativity, and that is the principle of equivalence. Okay, so principle and this principle basically tells you that gravity is a very different force from any other force, okay, as you will see in a minute. So in the simplest form, you can say that the principle of equivalence tells you that basically all bodies behave exactly the same way in the gravitational field. Okay, so that's so all bodies. Behave the same way in gravitational field. So in particular, what it means is that they all experience the same acceleration. Okay. So now this may seem trivial because already in the high school you were writing the simplest equation you can write down and that is mg equals to ma, for example, for the bodies moving in the uniform gravitational field of the Earth. Right? So take an example. We have that force is equal to mg. That's the gravitational force acting on bodies in homogeneous gravitational field of the Earth. And that's equal to ma, which is the Newton's law. Right? And so from here, you see that it's very tempting to say, well, the m on the left-hand side is the m on the right-hand side, and hence all the bodies behave with the same acceleration equal to small g, the gravitational acceleration. However, there is a, you know, it's not so simple. And the reason is that these two masses, in fact, are very different masses. One of them is the inertial mass, so let's call it mi. So this is the inertial mass. And that's basically, you know, how does the body respond to a force, right? So what is the... So if you want to accelerate somebody and apply some force, then, you know, this mi tells you how much the body reacts to this force. On the other hand, this m over here, it's mg, it's a gravitational mass. And that tells you, you know, how much is the response to gravitational field, right? And so there is no reason a priori why these two masses should be the same. Okay, so then what the principle of equivalence tells you that in fact they actually are the same, or more precisely, that if you take the ratio mg over mi, this will be equal to a constant, presumably one if you choose the units right. Okay, but what is even more interesting is that it is the same constant for all possible bodies you can think of, no matter what the matter content of the body is, no matter, you know, whether they are composed of, you know, whether they are additional electromagnetic fields or whatever. So, and this is this constant is the same for all bodies, independent of what they are made of. Okay, and so this is a very, very different property than what you experience, for example, in electromagnetism, right? So compare this, so CF, compare to electromagnetism, for example. So if you write down the electromagnetic force, well, of course, the Newton's law is still the same, so mi equals to a, but now the electromagnetic force, if there is no magnetic field or whatever, is just Q times E. Okay. So now the Q plays the role of the electromagnetic mass. Okay. But now the difference is obvious, right? So this thing here better be true for all the bodies. So now I would expect that in electromagnetism, if the same were true, then Q over mi would be constant. Well, there are some bodies for which you can set, you know, the unit so that this will be equal to constant. And if you take any other body, it will not be the same constant. So for you can have different charges, you can have matter which is uncharged completely, you can have, you know, so this is not true. So this is not true, at least for all bodies, right? And then what it means is that actually gravity is very, very different from electromagnetism, okay? What it also means, basically, this fact is that I can always set g equal to a. It tells you, well, all the bodies behave the same in the gravitational field. Well, that's the first step to understand the gravitational field is actually geometrical. So if you have geometry and the bodies are moving in this geometry, independent of the body, all the bodies will move in that geometry the same way. So this is the origin of the fact that gravity is geometrical. So here, gravity can be geometrized. same is not true for electromagnetism, because I would have to find different geometry for this body, different geometry for that body, and then it doesn't make sense to geometrize it. Okay? So now, I told you, well, we are accustomed to the fact that mg over mi is a constant. Okay, but is there any proof of that? Okay, so y is m, how did I write it? Mg over mi equal to a constant. What do you think? Any ideas? It's correct not to have any ideas, because there are no ideas why that is the case. Okay, so there is one theory which sort of explains that, and it's called Max theory. Max theory of inertia. This theory basically tells you that maybe the gravitational mass or the inertial mass, well, it's the inertial mass, which comes actually from interaction of your body with distant stars. If there is lots of distant stars, then you can arrange this interaction such that this will be true. So that's the original idea which dates back to 1900 or something like that. It's the only theory I know of that really, you know, tries to explain why mg over mi is a constant. However, that theory is completely wrong, because it uses action at a distance, it's not relativistic, it's very old-fashioned, and so it cannot be right. So really, nobody knows why mg over mi is a constant. Nevertheless, what people can do is that they can do experiments. And then, you know, they test this equivalence principle for various bodies, and, you know, they try to find the departure from this constant, but they haven't found any at this point. Okay, so maybe this is actually true. Okay, but nobody knows why. So it's up to you to find why mg over mi is a constant. Okay? Very good. So now, that was the first observation Einstein made. And then another one, which he probably said was like the luckiest moment of his life, was like, okay, so if I can do this, I can also start thinking about elevators. So there's something which is called Einstein's elevator. And so imagine that you are an observer who is, however, confined to a small elevator. So you are confined to a box, and you don't see what is outside of the box. Okay? So this is the picture here. So this is you. Okay? And you are in this confined box. That's the elevator. And so because A equals to G, okay, as over there, it means that there shouldn't be difference between two situations, that the elevator accelerates up with the acceleration equal to g, or that the elevator is actually sitting on the earth and there is a gravitational field g over here. But basically, the statement is, the guy who is confined to this box, to this elevator, has no way telling which one is true, whether actually the elevator is accelerating up or whether there is a true gravitational field G pushing down over here. It's this very simple idea which gives you all the predictions of general relativity. Not all, but almost all, as we shall see in a minute. Okay? Any questions so far? All right, so let us apply this, okay? So this is a simple idea. You can start drawing pictures with this idea, and then, you know, you will see that there are some very important consequences. So one consequence, gravitational redshift. So consequences. So first, gravitational redshift. So now I will do a simple derivation of gravitational redshift using one simple quantity which you should know from special relativity, which is the Doppler shift. You know that if something is getting away from you, the frequency actually goes down. If it's coming to you, the frequency goes up. Okay, the same is true for light. Okay, so the frequency of the light is enhanced when the source is approaching you, and so on. Right, and so you will derive the exact formula in your tutorial on Friday. So don't worry if you don't know the exact description. I will just use it here, but let's see how this goes. Okay, so imagine that we are in the true gravitational field. Okay, so we're in this situation, and let's say we have a flashlight, and we send the light up there. Okay, so we send the light from here up there. Okay, and so the statement is that down at the elevator, the frequency of that light will be omega, and up, maybe it's something else, maybe it's omega prime. Okay, so you shine the light up there. Let's say that the elevator has height, which is delta H, and this is in uniform gravitational field G. And the question is, how is this omega related to omega prime? Is it the same, or is it different, or what happens? Right? So now, due to the equivalence principle, we know that this equals to that. So we can just write, well, we actually can look at this from the point of view of an accelerated elevator. Okay. So let's say that it takes time t for the light to actually cross the distance from here to there. Okay. So in that time, so I have this elevator here. It accelerates with the acceleration g. And in that time t, for which this is actually taking place, the elevator moves up a little bit, okay? So it will be actually over here later on. Okay, so now what is this distance here? So this guy is delta H. This distance will be 1/2 g t squared if it takes time t. You're just using the Newtonian physics. But also the elevator in the end, if it starts from the rest, it will be moving with the velocity g times t. Okay, just the velocity here is g times t. So now the fact that the light moves at the speed of light, we know that delta H is c times t. That's how we define the time t. And the velocity is g times t of the elevator over here. So if I plug in for t, this will be equal to g times, from here, delta H over C. Okay, so now what I'm doing here really, so, you know, this may seem a little bit inconsistent, but almost it's consistent. What I'm assuming is that the speed of light is, you know, huge, and the velocity of the motion is super, super small, as you are used to that. In principle, you could be writing that actually the distance the light travels from here, actually goes from here all the way to here. The distance is actually delta H, which is delta H plus 1/2 gt squared, right? But the distance here, because the velocity is really, really small, can be you can neglect it, and so you can just write this thing here, right? All right, so that's the relation between the velocity of the elevator here when it actually perceives the signal, which was sent down here, okay? So now we use the Doppler shift formula. So basically what happens is that you shine the light, but now the light is observed over here at the top of the elevator, but the top of the elevator is moving away from the light. So you can immediately say that actually the frequency will be smaller because the elevator is moving away, and then there will be a gravitational redshift consequently. So let's calculate what this redshift actually is. So let's just use fancy notation of special relativity, although you don't have to do that, but let's do it. So at the bottom, you have the wave vector k mu describing your light, which is omega over c. Now it's in Cartesian coordinates, so it's t direction, x, y is there's no, and then z direction is 1. You can do it much more simply, okay, but let's do it this way. Let's pretend that we do real physics, okay? So now on the top, there will be a different wave vector, k prime mu, which will be this omega prime over c, again, 1, 0, 0, 1, right? But because you now look at this from the moving system, there will be this Doppler shift, okay? There is the Doppler shift. And you will calculate that in your tutorial on Friday. And there's a very complicated relativistic formula, and as you will see, we will not need it, but anyway. So the relativistic formula is that the omega prime, because the thing is moving away, is related to omega in this way. It's related to the Lorentz gamma factor, gamma, omega over c, but there's also 1 minus beta, and that's 1, 0, 0, 1. So beta is v over c, and gamma is this 1 over 1 minus v square over c square. It's the standard Lorentz factor. Okay. So now remember that we are again, you know, so what we will be plugging here is the velocity of the elevator at the top. Okay. But again, we are using the fact that v is much, much smaller than c. We already are in that approximation. So basically, in that case, we are throwing away all the terms which are not linear in V over C. Okay, we just keep the linear term in V over C. Which means that gamma has 1 over 1 minus V square over C square. So that's 1, okay, because that's higher order in V over C. And beta, so we just keep beta here. So this is omega over C, 1 minus V over C, 1, 0, 0, 1. Okay, very good. So now if I'm comparing, and so this thing here is omega prime over c. Here is omega prime over c. So I can immediately read from here, just the Doppler shift formula, how is omega prime related to omega. And so omega prime is just omega times 1 minus v over c. And then I can express it in terms of this g delta h c. The v is given by the formula over here. So this is omega 1 minus g delta h over c square. Okay? So that's how the frequency got diminished in the gravitational field. Okay? You can also express it in terms of the redshift. And the redshift is defined as whatever you receive minus whatever you send divided by whatever you send. Okay, so that's what redshift factor is called. And this just becomes minus g delta h over c squared. Okay, so that's our result. So how much the light got redshifted in the gravitational field. So now if you think about it, you know, it's very trivial, right? So I start somewhere here at the bottom of the gravitational potential. So now I shine the light, right? And as I shine the light has to climb up the gravitational potential. Because it's climbing up, it's losing energy. Energy is given by the frequency. It's losing frequency. So that's why there will be a gravitational redshift. Okay, questions? Okay, yeah, please use secret questions if you want, but please don't be afraid to ask me direct questions, okay?
Okay, so the photons are rather up there. Yes.
Where is that 1001 coming from?
Oh, this thing here. So I'm just writing the K mu, the wave vector, as a vector. And so what I'm using here is the Cartesian coordinate. Okay, so you have coordinates t, x, y, and z. Okay, and so, of course, this has to be a null vector, which means that I have to go the same direction in the time direction, the same size in the time direction and in the space direction. But I'm moving only up. So I'm moving only in the z direction. So that's why that will be 1, 1, and this is 0, 0, because I'm not moving in that direction. Okay? But, you know, you don't have to really use this thing. All you need to know is that, you know, there's a redshift formula, which is that omega prime is omega times 1 minus v over c in the first approximation. Right? It's just redshift. So now, interestingly, you know, this, yes?
So just to make sure where we start from, so basically, so MG or MI argument allows us to identify just being in the gravitational field to the
acceleration.
Accelerated motion, and this motion causes redshift. Okay.
Exactly. Very good. So now, you know, has this been measured? And the answer is yes. It's, you know, one of the, well, not really the first test of general relativity, but one of the very important tests of general relativity. And so it's been measured by Hound and Epka in 1960. And what they were really playing is that they had the flashlight, and one of them was down at the tower, and the other one was up the tower, and the delta H was something like 23 meters of the tower. And if you calculate the redshift from here, this minus g delta h over c square, of course c is huge, then the redshift is teeny tiny. It's 2.5 times 10 to minus 15, which you can easily calculate. So g is 10, delta h is 23, so this is like 200, and c is 10 to the 8, square is 10 to the 16. So we are suddenly at this range, 10 to minus 15. So that's the redshift of frequency. But nevertheless, they were good experimentators, and so they could measure this, and it's a confirmation of GR. Okay. So we have first test of GR, which GR passed. Okay. Let me say one more thing here. So you know that the frequency is typically given by 1 over tau, by 1 over the period. Okay. So if tau measures some kind of proper time of you, so let's say I have my clock, and then tau measures like how long it takes from one click to another click. Okay, so let's put it here. Note that omega is proportional to 1 over tau, okay? However, if the frequency is lower at the bottom, is higher at the bottom and lower on the top, then with the proper time, it has to be vice versa, right? What it means is that in strong gravitational field, time goes more slowly. And so we have immediately that prediction as well. So maybe you've seen the Interstellar movie, how the guys actually go to the black hole, and then they come back 100 years later or something like, well, I don't know, 20 years later, although they spend there only 1 minute or something like that. So this is precisely that. So if you go to a strong gravitational field and you stay there and then you come back, you will be much younger.
because your time went much more slowly in that strong gravitational field. Yes?
Whose proper time is this? Because the photon doesn't have a proper time.
Oh, no, no. So, very good. So, this would be a proper time of an observer who sits down there in the gravitational potential. You can think about this like I'm really measuring. So now I'm real being measuring clicks between, you know, showed on my clock or whatever, right? The statement is, this thing still be true, right? It's, I can maybe, I don't know, associate my clicks of the clock with the frequency of the photon, whatever. I don't have to do that, right? Anyway, so this is the proper time that you know, lapses on my clock, and the statement is this will be going more slowly in the strong gravitation down there, in the strong gravitational field, than up there, okay? Okay, so I have one advice for you. You already know from special relativity that if you want to stay young, you better move fast, right? Because of the Lorentz factor and stuff like that. So now, if you want to stay young, you better stay close to some heavy objects with strong gravitational fields. So books are good, right? So if you stay close to books and study a lot, then you know, they produce strong gravitational field, and then your time will go more slowly. Questions? Very good. Yeah.
So is it kind of like? If you throw a ball upward, then it loses kinetic energy. If it goes up in the gravitational field, that is kind of the same analogy here.
It's very, you know, Newton's mechanical concept of that. But yeah, in principle, yes, you can think about it that way. It's like really you are using, well, you have to climb the gravitational potential. Yeah. And then you are losing energy. Yeah, exactly. I like that. Very good. So that's first prediction. Another very important prediction, which actually Einstein knew about 1911, I think, is the bending of light. So that was first prediction. The next prediction is bending of light. So now, the fact that the trajectory of light can be affected by gravitational field is something which is not, you know, completely intuitive from Newtonian point of view. Because from Newtonian point of view, the photons really don't have mass which could be affected by the gravitational field, so there wouldn't be really a force acting on a photon. But even if you assign the photon a mass, and you will do it in one of your homeworks, you will find that you are off by a factor of 2. So from Newtonian perspective, you know, bending of light is something very, very, you know, you can do it artificially, but you get it twice as wrong. Okay, so now how does this work here? Right, so let's see, I have a picture, there's no gravitational field at all, and I just send the light, and the light of course goes straight here, right, and so now that's true if I am this in this empty space, but now let me put an elevator in this empty space. Okay, at some instant of time, the elevator will look like this. Okay. So if there is a hole through which the light can actually go to that elevator, you know, at that instant of time when the light enters, I see, you know, this height where it enters to that elevator. Okay. So then later on, let's say that my elevator mimics the gravitational field. So again, it is accelerated upwards. Okay, so later on, so this thing here is accelerating upwards with the gravitational acceleration. So now a little bit later, the elevator is up here. Okay. And let's say the light is over here. Okay. But now, if you look at where the light is with respect to the bottom of your elevator, now, it's this height here. Okay, it's smaller height than you started with. Okay, even later, the elevator will be here. Let's say here. So this is 1, 2, 3. The light is here. And so this is the height of the light. So what the guy inside the elevator, inside of this accelerated elevator sees
is that he doesn't see that he's actually accelerating empty space. What he only sees is like what the light is doing inside the elevator. And what he sees is that the light is doing something like this. Right? So this is the... That's one. That's two. That's three. But because of our Einstein's elevator and equivalence, of course, what it means is that if we have true gravitational field like this, and we don't need an elevator, can we move the elevator? Now we, well, let's say we have that, we will see the bending of light like that. So you just shown that the trajectories of light need necessarily to bend by the gravitational field. Okay? Just because by using this Einstein's elevator. Okay? So we can again calculate this exactly, but and you will do it in your homework later on. So for exact calculation, see, I don't know, homework 2 or 3 or something like that. See homework. And you will do it. So this is in uniform gravitational field, but you will do it in, you know, on the Earth, so it'll be spherical gravitational field. And you will also compare like what happens if you really force Newtonian gravity to bend at light, you will see the factor of 2. Okay, which is wrong. Okay, so. Very good. So that's another very, very amazing prediction which immediately comes from your equivalence principle. The light is bent. Okay. So now let me quiz this very simple idea. Oh, first of all, are there any questions? Any questions? So far. Isn't this fun, just drawing elevators and seeing what they do? I don't know if you're going to have lecture with Pedro Vieira, who is a esteemed faculty here, but he will tell you never play with the elevators, just do hard calculations. Okay, but as we see here, it's actually fun to do, you know, to draw elevators and derive very important results without doing any calculations. So, anyway. All right, so now let me twist that idea of Einstein elevator. So, here we said, okay, very good. So, if I am in uniform gravitational field, I can mimic that by accelerating upwards. The question is, if I am in real gravitational field, can I get rid of gravitational field? How would I get rid of the gravitational field? Can I just twist this idea? Any ideas? Can I get rid of the gravitational field of the Earth?
Accelerate in the opposite direction.
Exactly. So now if I am in true gravitational field, but accelerate downwards with the same acceleration as the gravitational field, I'm actually sort of freely falling. And there won't be any gravitational field. So let's call it, it's called local inertial frame. And basically the statement is we... And I will put locally, just to make you more confused at this point, but I'll hopefully clarify this at the end of the lecture. We can locally get rid of the gravitational field by going to the freely falling frame. Freely falling frame. So in other words, the two situations will be the same. I am in empty space, there is nothing going on here. Oh, this is like there's no gravity here. No gravity. And the guy who's in this elevator will see no gravitational effects whatsoever. This elevator is not accelerating, it's just standing there in empty space. And this better be the same as if I am in gravitational field. So there's a true gravitational field down here. But now I'm accelerating downward with that with the same gravitational acceleration. And if that is true, you know, the measurements of this guy here will be exactly the same as the measurement of this guy over there. Okay? I got rid of gravity by going to the freely falling frame. So now, why is this useful? Is that, well, now we can use the laws of physics as we know them without gravitational field. And you know all of them. You know special relativity, you know electromagnetism, you know all these laws, right? So the gravity, including gravity, is problem, right? But without gravity, I know everything. It's just given by special relativity. So in this frame, I can use special relativity. We can use special relativity, use known physics which is special relativity. Do we have any secret questions? Maybe. Do we have any real questions? No, those are also real, okay? Those are also real. Okay, so, you know, if we are in this frame, we know everything. We know how to solve physics, okay? It's the inclusion of gravitational field, which may be problematic. But let's see that it's actually not. Okay, let me demonstrate that on geodesic equation, on the motion of particles. Okay, so let's see. Let's apply this. Apply the Einstein elevator again to motion of particles or light or whatever. Okay. And this will be described by geodesic equation. So now, what do we know? If we are in the freely falling frame, well, how do the trajectories look like if there is no external force? If there is no electromagnetic force or nothing like that, how do the trajectories look like? I send something, what does it do?
It goes on a straight line.
It goes on a straight line, perfect. So in freely falling frame, let me emphasize it here that it's really, I am not putting any external force, no electromagnetic force or nothing like that. In freely falling frame, we have straight line. Okay. So let's say that I equipped, you know, this freely falling frame with some coordinates x mu. Okay. So xi mu coordinates. This will be my Cartesian coordinates, well, Lorentzian coordinates, t, x, y, z coordinates in that freely falling frame. And I have to describe a straight line. Straight line is characterized by, if I differentiate it twice, I get zero. Okay? So in this freely falling frame, my equation of motion must look like d square xi mu d tau square equals to zero. Okay, so that's my equation of motion in that freely falling frame. In the Cartesian coordinates, this is what describes straight line. The question is, now, what happens if I am no longer in the freely falling frame, if I include gravity? Okay. I simply can go to a different frame. I can go to the frame which is not accelerating. If it's not accelerating, then it will suddenly see this gravitational field, and this equation will get modified. So now what happens? Question is, what happens in some other frame? For example, the one which sees gravity, and let's denote the corresponding coordinates as x alpha coordinates. So we have the inertial frame coordinates xi mu, which are the freely falling frame coordinates, and then we have some other frame where maybe gravity is present, because I am no longer accelerating downwards, and that will be the corresponding coordinates x alpha. So the question is then, how does my equation look like in the presence of gravity in this non-freely falling frame? Okay, so how do we rewrite this? So what we assume is that there is some relationship between these coordinates x and xi. We need to know that, right? So we assume that x alpha is some function of this xi mu. So this is what's given to us. Right? For example, I'm not accelerating downwards, so I'm sitting on the earth, so I know what the coordinate change is between the two. Okay? So now all we have to do is just to rewrite this geodesic equation in the freely falling frame into the new coordinates. So let's do it. So we have d square psi mu d tau square. So what is this? It's d over d tau. Okay, and now it's d xi mu over d tau, but now I treat xi mu as a function of x. It will be d xi mu over dx alpha, dx alpha over d tau. Using the, what is it, chain rule. So far, everybody happy? All right, so now this is unpleasant. I have to differentiate a product. I have to use the Leibniz rule. So let's do it. So if I differentiate this thing here, let's say first this one here. So it will be d square xi mu dx beta dx alpha dx beta over d tau dx alpha d tau. So that happens when I differentiate this guy here. And then I have to differentiate the other one as well. So it's plus d xi mu over dx alpha. D square x alpha d tau square. Okay, and this is equal to zero, because we started when it was equal to zero. Okay, so we just use the Leibniz rule here. Okay, now that's the trick. Okay, that's the trick is always how to write one in a complicated way. Okay, so that's most of the data tricks. So now if somebody maybe tell me, well, this thing here is equal to, so if I write dx, let me use the right indices, dx nu over dx alpha, what is this thing here? If I have two coordinates, x nu, x alpha, what is that equal to? Perfect. That's delta nu alpha. But I can also write it in a much more complicated way. I know that x is a function of xi, so I can also write it as dx nu over the xi mu, dxi mu over dx alpha. Okay, so we have this identity over here. Simple, but very powerful, right? Okay, so now what does that mean? If you look at the expression over here, you wait. Now, if you look at this equation which we have over here, we probably want to kill this term over here so that we just have the standard dx squared over d tau squared. Okay, how do we do that? We have dx mu over dx alpha, which is this thing here. So now we just have to multiply our equation by dx nu over dx mu, and that will just bring me delta. So there will be a delta here. But then delta I can pull through this guy, because delta is just a constant. It's just 0 or 1. So I can put it through here. Okay. So what we do is that we multiply this by dx nu over dx psi mu. Okay. And then by multiplying that, you just get delta nu alpha, which means that just this alpha here changes to nu. So we have equation d square x nu divided by d tau square plus d x nu d psi mu d square psi mu d x beta d x alpha dx beta d tau dx alpha d tau equals to 0. Okay? So I just multiply by this dx nu over dx I mu. The first term is exactly as it were, just plus this term, but the second term gets simplified now. All right. So, we are done, almost. This looks like acceleration. That's good. This looks like velocity, ub and u alpha, as you know it from special relativity. Okay. So now, what is this beast? This beast looks very complicated. Right? It's some horrible, horrible thing. So, whenever you see a horrible, horrible thing, the best thing to do is just to rename it. Call it something so that you don't have to deal with that horrible thing. Okay, let me call that. So you see, so there's a sum over mu here. So the mu index is gone, right? So the only index which is left is nu beta alpha. Let's call it gamma. Why not? Nu beta alpha. Okay, we just denote that horrible, horrible thing with something which looks simpler. A little bit simpler. It's a new symbol, gamma nu beta alpha. It's called Christoffel symbol. Okay, once we do that, we arrive at the geodesic equation in full general relativity. It's written as this. D square x nu d tau square, let me just write it, plus gamma nu alpha beta d x alpha d x beta d tau equals to 0. That's your geodesic equation. We haven't used any differential geometry or nothing here, but we have derived how the particles and light will move in the gravitational field. Okay, so that's the geodesic equation. Isn't this amazing? Just using the Einstein's elevator, we now have geodesic equation. Okay. Now, if you look at what this beta alpha. Is there any symmetries? How many of these beasts are there, right? So there's a beast gamma, which has nu beta alpha indices. Each of them runs from 0 to 3 or whatever. So each of them has like 4 possible values. So it's like 4, 4, 4. Seems like a lot of components here of this tensor. However, there's one simplification. If you look at the definition, it's d over dx beta, d over dx alpha. What happens if I do d over dx alpha, d over dx beta? We are in physics. Nothing happens, right? The partial derivatives commute, right? So I can swap these two, and it's fine. So this guy will be symmetric. So this is, so typically people denote that it's symmetric by these kind of brackets here. And so these two indices, it will be symmetric in these two indices, right? It's also highlighted by the fact that you multiply by u alpha, u beta. These are the two same objects. So this is symmetric in alpha and beta. I can swap these two. So this has to be symmetric in alpha and beta as well. Right, so there's a little bit less components. So now, how many objects with two symmetric indices? If I don't have this index, in four dimensions, how many objects like this? You have a matrix with two indices, but it has to be symmetric matrix. How many are there? Uh-huh. Anybody else? Oh, you can say it. It's 10. It's 10, right? I have a matrix, and I have four components here, and then three components here, because that one is already given, then two components here, and then one component here. So that's 10 components, okay? So now this guy here is, moreover, this index new. There's no any other symmetry here. So it's 4 times 10. So this guy will have 4 times 10, which is 40 components. Describing your gravitational field, okay? So if you know these 40 components, you can solve this equation here.
How do we physically interpret the Christoffel symbol?
How are we going to interpret that Christoffel symbol? As basically the gravitational gravitational acceleration. You will see. You will get there. So basically, you know, this. So now what is really important for us is that this equation somehow, in the right limit, has to go to the standard Newton's law, where you know that the acceleration is given by the gravitational force. So this looks like an acceleration, right? So the acceleration is given by the gravitational force. The gravitational force is mg, right? So this thing here really somehow describes the gravitational acceleration, g. And of course it has to, because it was zero in the freely falling frame, and now I said, well, we are not in the freely falling frame, so we suddenly got this addition to our equation, and it has to be related to the gravitational acceleration g. Very good. So you know, this thing here should reduce. So we will see next time. You will see that this equation for, you know, static and weak gravitational field. Basically, this equation becomes A is equal to G, right? Or if you want to write it in a more fancy way, it will be d square of x dt square, something like mg. Right, and which is something like, you can write this in terms of the potential, it's minus m times radiant of phi, where phi is the gravitational potential. Okay, so that what we will see next time is that equation in the right limit, in the Newtonian limit, gives you the Newtonian prescription. Questions? So we have geodesic equation. So now let me rewrite it in a more fancy way. So far, we have just denoted, you know, this beast here. We said, you know, we just don't like to work with this thing here. We like this symbol more. So we wrote it in terms of this symbol. But let me write something, this symbol, in maybe slightly different way. Okay? Unless there are questions. Please think about questions. Please, one question, okay?
To, for example, how the Newton's law gets modified when I go to like a rotating frame.
Exactly. So of course, you know, here I didn't say necessarily that it has to be gravitational field G, right? So here we are saying, well, I can relate my inertial field following coordinates to any other coordinates. They can be rotating coordinates, they can be accelerating coordinates, they can be any coordinates you can write down. So in principle, this equation here knows about all, how they are called, fictitious forces like Coriolis force or so all kind of non-inertial forces are encoded in this equation. Okay, so very, very powerful equation.
David?
Yes.
So this equation holds if I'm going between two inertial frames as well, right?
Sure.
How do the Christoffel symbols look if we're in that, I mean, if we're still in Minkowski space?
Oh, very good. So let's say, well, you can be in Minkowski space, but the question is, are you still using the Cartesian coordinates? If you are, what you are really doing is a Lorentz transformation, right? If you are doing the Lorentz transformation, the Lorentz transformation is linear transformation. You are going from x to lambda times x. You call it x prime. So x prime is lambda times x, where lambda is a constant. Right? That's what your Lorentz transformation is.
That's zero.
So indeed, this thing here will vanish in my other inertial frame, and I will get the same inertial equation in that new frame. Thank you so much for that question. Very good. So it's very important that this thing here is quadratic, and so you know it will vanish for linear transformations like Lorentz transformation or rotation or whatever.
So having a Coriolis force is like equivalent to having gravity?
Of course. Yeah. Of course. Not quite, but almost. If I have 5 minutes at the end, I will discuss this a little bit. Okay. So now let me rewrite this. Formula, let me give you another formula for gamma, okay? So how do we do that? So first step is to introduce the curved metric, okay? So curved metric. So how is this done? So you know that in special relativity, or in the freely falling frame, in inertia frame, we know that the light, well, the what is it, line element, is given by the Minkowski metric. Okay, so this is equal to, by the way, it's equal to minus d tau square, where I'm setting c equal to 1. But anyway, so it's the minus proper time square. That's given by the Minkowski metric, eta mu nu, d xi mu, d xi nu, right? This is the Minkowski thing. It's minus 1, plus 1, plus 1, plus 1. Or if you want and come from higher energy physics community, it's plus 1, minus 1, minus 1, minus 1. Okay, it doesn't matter. But please don't put minus here, okay? I've seen that convention as well. So it's, for example, in Zwieback's book on string theory. So he uses the right convention, the relativistic convention, general relativistic convention, plus 1, minus 1, minus 1, plus 1, plus 1, plus 1. But to be consistent in this high energy physics community, he puts a minus here. Okay? So don't do that, please. So many conventions. Okay? Anyway, so this guy, for me, it will be minus 1, minus 1, 1, diagonal matrix, minus 1, plus 1, plus 1, plus 1. All right? So that's the flat metric. However, now I can write down the curve metric by saying, well, I know what my transformation from xi to x is, right? I just calculate what these differentials are in terms of the x's. So this will be eta mu nu, and that will be d xi mu, dx alpha, that will be d xi nu, dx beta, dx alpha, dx beta. Okay, I just use the chain rule again. This thing here is my d xi mu, and this thing here is the other one, right? Okay, very good. But now this looks like, look at this. So mu is contracted as mu over here, so there's no mu index here. Nu is contracted as this index here, there's no nu. But the only two indices here are alpha and beta. So if I denote this as g alpha beta, then it's just equal to dx alpha. Okay? So then ds square is just g alpha beta dx alpha dx beta, where g alpha beta is my curve metric, and that's given by eta mu nu d xi mu dx alpha dx nu d, what am I writing, d xi mu d xi nu dx beta, right? So that's my definition of what I will say it's a curve metric. So now this curve metric g alpha beta need not be minus 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1. If I come up with a crazy coordinate transformation, these things will be crazy, and in the end this will depend on the coordinates. So g alpha beta is a function of coordinates now, right? And that's what I call a curve metric. All right. So now the statement is, if I have this curve metric, I can write a beautiful formula. Well, whether it's beautiful or not depends on what you consider beautiful. For this Christoffel symbol over here. Okay, let me write what that formula is. So first of all, I can introduce another Christoffel symbol with index down. People don't like it, but they can do it. Okay, so we have nu alpha beta. Let's call it mu alpha beta, and that will simply be given by g mu nu comma nu alpha beta. So in the same way as you lower or rise indices with the flat metric eta mu nu, you can rise or lower indices with the curve metric g mu nu. Okay, so what I have done here is that I lowered this index with this metric g mu nu. Okay, this is called Christoffel symbol of the second kind. So Christoffel second kind. We just lower the index, right? So who cares? Right? But anyway, so it's okay. So now for this one, you have a beautiful formula. By the way, if you look at the definition of g alpha beta, it has this d xi of dx alpha, right? Okay, so that's what can bring some non-trivial dependence on the x coordinate. Okay. Now, if you look at this Christoffel symbol here, it has d square of xi over dx alpha dx beta. It's like another derivative. Okay. So what you immediately expect is that this gamma here behaves like a derivative of the curve metric, right? Sort of, right? So this thing here, so gamma is something like dg, right? So that's what you would expect immediately, because this thing has only one derivative. This thing here has two derivatives, so it might work. Okay? So now what the precise formula is 1/2, and there are three terms, and they have to respect the symmetry. The symmetry is that this object is symmetric in alpha and beta. Okay? So how do I respect the symmetry? I put g mu alpha beta, partial derivative with respect to dx over dx beta. Okay? So this is a partial derivative with respect to beta. Have you seen all this notation? Who hasn't seen this notation? Has it been used? This notation? No? Partial derivative? No? Okay, so comma alpha means d over dx alpha. Okay? Any other notation you haven't seen? Do you know what Einstein summation convention is? That you sum over two the same indices, and the index is gone. It just means I'm summing over all the possible values of the index, but in the end, the index is not present in the final formula. Right? Okay, very good. So partial derivative is comma alpha. It's like d over dx alpha of something. Right? So whatever I differentiate here will be like that. Okay, so this is t over dx beta of gamma mu alpha. Very good. So this doesn't look symmetric in alpha and beta. So I have to add another term, which makes it symmetric. So I add the same term, g mu, where I swap the two indices, beta and alpha. Now I'm happy. I have both indices there. It's symmetric. That's not everything. I can also do minus g alpha beta over mu. Symmetric is symmetric in alpha and beta, by definition. So this term is allowed by symmetry. And that's the final formula. Okay, so that's another formula for your Christoffel symbol, but now in terms of the Genf metric. Okay, so I'm just giving you this formula. I better prove it as well. Okay, I don't want to prove it, but let me just outline the proof. Okay, it's painful. It's painful. It's your homework. Okay, painful things will be your homework. Simple things I can do. Okay, not really. It's not your homework. Up to you. So how will you prove this formula? We have to calculate some of these things over here, right? So let me calculate what the first term is. So what g mu alpha beta is, right? So what is this thing here? Okay, so it's d over dx beta, and then g mu alpha. But what g mu alpha is eta. Let me just change the index from mu and nu now to something else, kappa delta, kappa sigma, and d psi kappa dx mu, d psi sigma, dx alpha. Right, so this is what I call g mu alpha. But I'm just using now different index so that I don't sum over three same indices or something like that, right? Okay, very good. So now this thing here is just a flat metric, plus one, minus one, minus one, minus one, plus one, plus one, plus one. It's a constant. I can take it out of the derivative. Okay, so this is eta kappa sigma. And then I have, again, two terms to differentiate here. I have this term differentiate and that term differentiate. So now it's d square psi kappa divided by dx theta dx mu d psi sigma over dx alpha. I differentiated the first term. Now I differentiate the second term. Plus d psi kappa dx mu d square psi sigma dx beta d x alpha. All right. So now you see that, you know, the second derivative term here, which is present over here, starting to emerge, right? Okay. So the statement is that this thing over here can be written as d psi kappa d x iota, another index, gamma iota beta mu. Well, let's see if that is true. So we have d psi kappa over d x iota, and then use this formula here. So it's dx iota over d psi, I don't know, another index again, d square psi delta. That's why I don't like this. D x beta d x mu. Okay, so I just plugged in the definition of gamma iota beta mu. Okay, maybe. So now, if you look at this thing here, is that dx iota here. So this is, you're summing over that. So what is really written here is d xi kappa over d xi delta. So now if you combine these two things, it just gives you delta kappa delta. Okay? And that's what's written over here. Okay? So anyway, so you have this thing here, and hence, so okay, very good. So this time here is this thing times that thing. And similarly for the other term. So you would find that actually this thing here is nothing else than gamma alpha beta mu plus gamma mu alpha and beta. Okay. Try it. Okay, there's this one more step missing, which, you know, it's not very alienating. Okay, so one derivative gives you two gammas. Other derivative, you just swap some indices. You have already done the work, so you can do the other term. That will give you two gammas. The last thing will give you other two gammas. Okay, so now if you add the right gammas and subtract the right gammas, according to this formula over here, hopefully it gives you the gamma. You can try. Is this clear what needs to be done, or do you want me to do it? It's so painful to do it. Okay. So let's say it's proved. If you have problems proving it, maybe you can do it as a tutorial. I don't know. All right. So. Modulo the proof, which is just pure pain. We have a new beautiful, yes?
Sorry, I just missed what you said when you were writing the sum of the two gammas. Where is that equal coming from? Is that a continuation of this?
Sorry. So maybe I'm a pure mess, right? So you happy with this? Okay, very good. So now I just, all I do is I take the eta out, and then I differentiate this guy times that guy, and differentiate this guy and times this guy. So it's these two terms, right? So now the key point is to rewrite this d squared psi kappa dx beta dx mu in terms of the gamma. The statement is that this thing here is gamma times however this thing over there. And the proof is here, okay? Like I'm just plugging what the gamma is, and then you can show that it's exactly that, right? So similarly, the same term will give you something else times gamma, right? So you already have gamma times something. What that something is doing is just lowering the index. Okay, so that's why you will have gamma and gamma. I don't know, it's very schematic, but it's not important. It's not important for us. It's just an exercise, pure pain, okay? Very good, so we have a new beautiful formula for the Christoffel symbols. In terms of the curve metric, it's over there. Okay, so that's the right formula which you spell it always. Okay, so this one here is like when I just do some coordinate transformation, right? I need to know what that coordinate transformation is. But here, if I know what the curve metric is, I can calculate Christoffel symbols from from knowing what the metric is. So now, what is the difference between the two? Okay, so now we come to the crucial point of the lecture. So far, we were pretending that gravitational field is a uniform gravitational field G. Okay, we can get rid of that gravitational field by going to an accelerating frame downwards. However, that is true for any gravitational field, but only locally. Only locally, you can get rid of the acceleration of the gravitational field by accelerating downwards. The reason is that the real gravitational field may not be uniform. It may not be just pointing down. It may actually, you may have a spherical body, and the gravitational field is pointing to that body. So it will have the component, also this component. And the component will change as you go closer to the body. Okay, so that is the crucial part of the lecture. And so far, whatever we have done here is correct, except it's correct only locally. Okay, so let me call this a very important note, and we will finish on that today, is that so now, beware. Real gravitational field can be inhomogeneous. It can be time varying, and so on. So it always locally looks like the homogeneous gravitational field which we were discussing so far, but not globally. Okay. So only locally can be mimicked by acceleration, but not globally. So if I am to plot some picture here, is let's say you really have Earth here. Say this is the Earth. And then you know that the gravitational field goes like this. Right? So now if I have teeny tiny elevator, local elevator, here, or there, it doesn't matter, then inside the elevator, it will look like all the arrows are going down and they are homogeneous because the elevator is super, super small. Okay, so local elevator will see homogeneous gravitational field as we were describing it here. But now, if I make the elevator bigger, this is my elevator, global elevator. So this is a local one. Local. This one will be global. So you see that in that big elevator, actually my field doesn't look homogeneous. Looks like, you know, this is going here, it's going there, it's going there. It doesn't look homogeneous. Even if I do go to the freely falling frame, I don't know which one, but let's say I go to the freely falling frame with the middle. Okay? So I go, I get rid of this thing here. Okay? If I go. But because this thing here is tilted towards that, there will still be this part of the force going there. And there'll be this part of the force going there. Right? So there will be some things which are left over, even if I go to the freely falling frame. What these things are called tidal effects. You know them from the sea, you know, and the moon and whatever, from the tides. So there will be tidal effects. So even if you do go to the freely falling frame, in the global situation, you cannot get rid of the gravity everywhere. Right? What's left over is these tidal effects. now what is good news, right? Locally, everything is right, what we are doing so far. So locally, we still have the curve metric. So what remains the same? So good news. Good news is that gravitational field still described by the curve metric. So ds square equals to g mu nu dx mu dx nu. It's still true. What may not be true is that this metric, this curve metric, is related to the flat metric as I was writing there by a coordinate transformation. Okay? May not be, that may not be the case. But if you have curve metric, you still describe gravitational field. How many components this guy has? Again, we had that question already. Here it's a symmetric metric. 10. So if you have 10 components, this seems like very many, right? So if you take Newtonian theory, there's only one degree of freedom is the scale of potential, or so g is minus gradient of phi. Phi is the potential. So there's only one degree of freedom. Not really in the Newton's theory. There's no 2 degrees of freedom, but there's one component describing your Newtonian field. Here you have 10, many, many, many more. So it's much more complicated theory. In Maxwell theory, you have 6 degrees of, so 6 components for f mu nu. Here you have 10, okay? So that's the metric. What it means is, and this thing here really describes the gravitational field, right? Everything about gravitational field there is to describe is described by this g mu nu. What it means is that gravity becomes geometry because it's described by the metric. Metric measures geometry. Okay. However, you have to be very careful about gravity because as is the case with electromagnetic field, Einstein's gravity is a gauge theory. Means that not all these components of the metric actually are physical. There's some gauge freedom, as we shall see. Okay, so beware. Again, so gravity is a gauge theory. Is a gauge theory, which means not all the components of this g mu nu are, you know, important. That they are just, you know, redundant things in some sense. So now, if you want to describe these tidal forces, these tidal effects, right? So this precisely is the tidal effects which will distinguish whether you have uniform gravitational field, which means acceleration only, or whether you have true gravitational field, right? So these tidal effects here are somehow describing the true gravity when you remove the acceleration part, okay? These things here will be described by a very important object constructed from the metric, which is already gauge invariant. It's called Riemann tensor. Okay, so these guys are described by Riemann tensor. And they are sort of physical. So when we will be describing things, it will not be really in terms of the metric where there is a gauge freedom, but it will be in terms of something else. Okay, and so that will bring us to study, you know, the Riemann tensor, the Einstein tensor, and so on, and we will need differential geometry for that. So this is where the differential geometry comes in. So anyway, so I hope I've shown you today that there's this very important concept of Einstein's elevator connected to the equivalence principle. Nobody knows why the equivalence principle works. It's up to you to discover, to create a theory which would really force all the bodies to have the same inertial mass and the same gravitational mass. But once you accept that and you start drawing elevators, you can basically derive all the predictions of general relativity by doing pictures, right? You can derive the geodesic equation, you can derive what the curve metric is, and so on. But to really truly understand what is the difference between true gravitational field, which can have tidal effects, and the gravitational field, which is just acceleration, just homogeneous field, which will always be the case locally, but not globally, for that you will need differential geometry. Okay, so that's where we start next time. Questions? Yes?
Out of curiosity, is there any reason why you don't like the notation with the minus next to the...
I just don't like it. Sorry, I have no clever reason. I was just so surprised to see it. It's like, you know, so general relativity, as any other theory, is about conventions. There is 2 to the 4 conventions in general relativity which are commonly used. That one would add another 2 times, right? So I don't like that. But in principle, yes, some people do it. But it just seems strange that you would call ds squared to be minus, right? So after all, what you are really describing is a like line element, and why you should be calling line element minus the distance by the metric is very weird to me, but I have no clever reason, okay? It's just it adds another set of conventions which could be used, and it's already disastrous as it is. More questions?
So shouldn't I be able to prove the equivalence principle by like studying graviton scattering and then like seeing that if I had something like conservation of charge, that would be like an overdetermined system? I saw something like this in like Weinberg. So isn't that like a proof?
I mean, okay, we can have a debate about this. I don't think it's a proof, but it may be an indication that it may be the case. Yeah. let's have a debate later. You know, there's a very long way from scattering of gravitons to gravity, okay? As we will discuss it here. And maybe, yeah, okay. Okay, very good. Thank you.